Hello and welcome to Uncommon Law, my podcast about true stories from my life experience of over 50 years as a lawyer and trial judge. This is a look at the law from the inside out, stuff they don't teach in law school. This is Judge Rudy Greco, retired justice of the New York State Supreme Court. One of the biggest problems for criminal lawyers is representing somebody you might find personally abhorrent or reprehensible. And that's what this story is all about. Harvey was sent to me, referred to me by another lawyer, a friend of mine who was a tax lawyer, had no criminal experience at all. And Harvey was an employee. He was a salesman at a very successful new car dealership in Brooklyn, owned by the other lawyer's uncle. And they said he had a problem. They were vague about it. They said he had a criminal problem and he needed a criminal lawyer. Would I talk to him? He was a very valued employee because he was a terrific salesman. He was their best salesman. And they were concerned and they wanted to see him get good representation. And he would explain everything when and if I spoke to him. So we made an appointment for him to come for an interview. And criminal cases are funny. You know, they're sort of like onions. You know, you don't get the whole story right up front. You have to peel away layers of truth, and eventually, in most cases, you get to the bottom of the thing. Well, at first, I didn't know Harvey's real situation. The real situation was he was a rat. He was an informant, and I didn't find that out till later. And that was a good thing because. For me, I grew up in Sicilian culture. All my grandparents came from Sicily, all four of them. And Sicily was the crossroads of the Mediterranean. And because of its location, it was conquered and ruled by everybody but the indigenous Sicilian people. They didn't have anything to say about anything. First it was the Greeks, then it was the Arabs, then it was the Normans, and then the Bourbons and the Spaniards. Everybody but Sicilians ruled Sicily, and characteristically, the culture was such that you never spoke to the authorities and you never complained or spoke to them about anything because they would turn on you. They were there as oppressors. They weren't there for justice for the people. They were there for helping themselves, and anything you told them was used to your disadvantage. And so even in Brooklyn, after all these hundreds of years, a thousand years of Sicilian cultural history, it even showed up in Brooklyn when I was growing up. If one of your siblings or a neighbor or a cousin or anybody did something and you told on them, you tattled on them, you were reprimanded for being a squealer or a tattler or a rat. And it was worse than the one who committed the original offense that you were talking about. And sometimes it was physical. You might even get smacked in the face for reporting on somebody else. And it was just ingrained in the culture. So I grew up with a mindset that one of the lowest forms of life was being a rat or a squealer or a stool pigeon, all of those bad terms, you know, for somebody who was an informant. And I didn't know that Harvey was at first. When he first came to me, he told me a story about an altercation he had in a bar. He was like a swinging bachelor. He was in his early 40s, and he made a lot of money, and he was around socializing everywhere, just like anybody in his age group would in his circumstance. He had no family to speak of. And apparently he was at a bar and he got into some words with somebody else that was at the bar. And one thing led to another. And both of them had a few drinks. And the guy made an anti-Semitic remark. And Harvey was Jewish and he took real offense at it. And uncharacteristically, the guy got popped. Harvey hauled off and hit the guy, knocked him for a loop, knocked him on his can, and people stopped the fight and broke it up and everything else. But the guy he hit was embarrassed, and it turns out the guy he hit was also off-duty, an off-duty NYPD detective. And to cover himself and his embarrassment and everything else, he arrested Harvey on the spot for assault, this, that, and the other thing, even though he provoked it, and he knew it was he deserved it. And I don't even know if he swung first. I'm not so sure. I don't remember. It doesn't matter. But the thing is, he hauled Harvey in and started processing him. Now, Harvey got to make a phone call while he was being processed at the precinct. And now the truth came out. He called, made a phone call, and the people he spoke to on the other end got on the phone with the detective and told the detective drop the charges and drop them fast. The people that Harvey had spoken to on the other end were federal agents. I don't remember that they were FBI or DEA agents, Drug Enforcement Agency. But in any event, they spoke to the detective and explained that Harvey was a confidential informant of theirs. And he was a very valuable informant, and they had been using him to set up and trap drug dealers. And they had been very, very successful, and they wanted the charges dropped. And they told this detective, if you don't drop the charges, we'll go to your superiors, and we'll get them to drop the charges, and you'll look bad in the process because people are going to start investigating what really happened. And we know Harvey, he's not a troublemaker, and the likelihood is this will be more trouble for you than it is for him. Well, the detective dropped the charges, but he continued to harass Harvey for some time thereafter because he wanted Harvey now to be an informant for him. All detectives and agents look for confidential informants because it makes their job a lot easier makes them look good. They get the arrests, but the hard work is done mostly by the informants, all the legwork. And Harvey was really, really good at it. And they kept him. It turns out when he told me the story, they kept Harvey. They abused him because they exaggerated the possibility of his sentence way beyond. They kept telling him about the maximums of all of the charges. He had been arrested for cocaine possession. And he, as I say, he was a swinging bachelor. And cocaine was around in the early 80s when this all took place. And cocaine was a nice, easy way to attract beautiful, weak women who liked cocaine. And Harvey liked beautiful, weak women that liked cocaine. And they liked Harvey because he had plenty of cocaine. Well, that's how they arrested him. Anyway, Harvey was in telling me the story, and he told me some of the situations that they put him in, which were, his life was in jeopardy. And he was dealing with some pretty nasty drug guys as a confidential informant. And the thing had gone on so long that it became abusive. They were abusing him now. They overdid it, and they were using him, and they got away with it, and he had nowhere to turn, and he was disgusted. And I had a man-to-man talk with Harvey, and I said, look, you know, it's not worth it. I don't know. It doesn't sound like it's worth it to keep going. Any judge, if he hears the history of what you've done for these guys already, would be inclined to just cut you loose at this point in time. You've done more than pay your dues, any dues that you owe society or the government. And most judges, I think, in most cases, would be pretty sympathetic at this point in time, and they would recognize this for what it is, which is a case of overdoing it by the agents. And Harvey came to his own conclusion. He said, you know, I feel the same way, and he said, I'm going to stop cooperating with these guys. Well, as soon as he notified those agents, they had put him up for something else, and he says, no, I'm not going to do it. I'm stop cooperating. You do whatever you want to do. Take me to court. Whatever you want to do with the judge, I don't care. I'm not going to cooperate anymore. Well, good old agents, being wonderful law enforcement officers that they were, and seeing their pet informant leaving the ranch, as it were, going off the reservation, were desperate. They had him arrested under an order of observation. They made out affidavits saying that they wanted him arrested and incarcerated in a federal facility, which was, in this case, the Metropolitan Correctional Center, downtown Manhattan, which is the local federal jail for New York City. They wanted him sent to MCC for 30 days for observation to have the federal psychologist, psychiatrist, as the case may be, to evaluate him to see if he was capable of doing things on his own and making his own decisions. It was a ruse. They knew he was capable, but it was spite work. They could keep him now in jail, in effect, under this order of observation for 30 days. And the problem was, being in the federal jail, Harvey was deathly afraid of being uncovered. He may easily run into somebody who he set up for arrests. And everybody in the jail gossips and talks to people and relatives and family and associates, criminal associates outside the jail, et cetera, et cetera. And the truth could easily come out. And if it came out, Harvey was in possibly mortal danger. They could kill him. It wouldn't be the first guy they killed in jail for being an informant, and it wouldn't be the last. So he was really worried. Now, he had been in jail a couple of days under this order of observation when he called me, and it was a Saturday morning, and now he was desperate. He had another problem on top of his order of observation itself. His mother died. Harvey's elderly mother died, and he was the only child, and she lived in Los Angeles. And in Jewish religious practice, she had to be buried immediately or right away, you know, the next day. But he was the only child, and there was nobody to bury his mother. And he asked me, is there any way I could get him out on a furlough or something from this order of observation? So I said, I'll look into it as fast as I could. He said, please, I'm desperate. I don't know what to do. Plus, he says, I don't want to be hanging around this place. He said, because I'm always looking over my shoulder thinking I'm going to get discovered. So as I always did in situations where I was perplexed and didn't know exactly what to do, I called my mentor. My mentor was the executive director of the Queens County Bar Association, an older gentleman, Bill Weinstock, who was a saintly guy, very, very intelligent, probably the smartest man I've ever run across in my life. And Bill himself was father confessor to Governor Carey and Governor Cuomo, Mario Cuomo. They used to call him at 3 o'clock in the morning with the problems that they couldn't solve for advice. He was brilliant. So I told Bill the story, and he was quite sympathetic in any event. And he was Jewish. He understood the religious implications of the whole thing. He said, well, let me see. Let me think about this. I think I can call. He said, you know, the chief judge, the presiding judge of the federal courts in the Eastern District of New York, which is the headquartered in Brooklyn, where Harvey's case was pending from the very beginning. He said, is Jake Mishler. And Jake, he's a friend of mine. We went to law school together as kids. He says he's a crusty guy, and he puts up this facade of being a tough guy and a hard shell. But that's all a front, because as a young man, he helped out a friend and nearly lost his license in the process. And since then, he decided it was a better practice to appear to be crusty and hard-boiled rather than to be a soft touch. But he says underneath it all, he's a very sympathetic guy, and he's a decent guy. Let me call him up. And he did. And he explained to Mishler succinctly what was going on. And Mishler said, okay, Bill. He said, Bill told him, he said, this is a good friend of mine, is the defense lawyer here who represents this guy. He said, okay, I'll tell you what you do. Have him show up at my house first thing tomorrow morning, which was Sunday morning, was the next day. He says, you have him come Sunday morning to my apartment. Here's my address. And he had a beautiful co-op apartment in a nice area in Forest Hills, Queens, which wasn't far away. Tell him to bring a writ of habeas corpus, and I'll interview him and talk to him briefly. And if it's okay and it sounds good by me, I'll sign off and let the guy go to bury his mother. So I was delighted to hear that. That was something I could never come up with on my own. Next morning, early Sunday morning, 8 o'clock Sunday morning, I'm ringing, I'm through the doorman. I talked my way through the doorman, and I got up to the judge's apartment, rang the bell, and he comes to the door in his pajamas and a nice robe, and he lets me in. He says, come on in. He says, I know who you are. I know, you know, Bill Weinstock called me up about you. What's going on here? Tell me in your own words what's happening. And I did. I related the story. He asked me a couple of questions, and apparently I satisfied him and passed muster. He said, okay, I'm going to sign the writ of habeas corpus. You can get him released. You take this right over to Metropolitan Correctional Center and take this down to MCC, and they'll turn him out in your custody right away. I thanked him profusely, and he said, by the way, he's scheduled to appear for a hearing. I looked up his case yesterday, and he's scheduled to appear before me on Tuesday. This is Sunday. He said, it's Sunday morning. You get him out to the airport, and you tell him to get his mother buried, and I expect him to make his appointment on Tuesday and be in court on Tuesday. And if he doesn't come to court on Tuesday, you be prepared to take his place in the jail cell, because I'm going to hold it against you. Now, I don't know if he really meant it, but it sounded good, and I wasn't going to argue with him. And I said, okay, fine. And I said, no, it'll be no problem, but I had my fingers crossed, you know, to make sure. And I went immediately downtown. There was no traffic Sunday morning, and I got Harvey out on the spot, which he was very relieved and very gratified, drove him to the airport, JFK, and put him on a plane to Los Angeles, where he arrived, did his duty, buried his mother, and came back and appeared in court on Tuesday. at which time the judge, it happened to be Judge Mishler, had probably familiarized himself in some detail with this case. And what was a minor thing, this order of observation on the judge's docket, you know, was now personal. And he terminated the order. He knew it was nonsense and it was a ruse to begin with. And it was, he saw through it and he knew what the agents were doing. They were just spiting Harvey. And he cut him loose. And Harvey was a happy camper and he was doing great for the next couple of months until he wasn't. And by that, I mean, I got a phone call about 3 or 4 months later. I don't even know. I don't remember now. It was a long time ago. Who made the call? But Harvey was found dead. He was executed, and they found him in the trunk of a car in a black garbage bag with a bullet in his head. And I dug into the case, and it took me a while, and I found out what happened. And what happened was this. One of the U.S. attorneys, one of the assistant U.S. attorneys on a case that Harvey was involved in, had to surrender or had to give over as a matter of discovery, required discovery to the defense lawyers, certain paperwork on the case, affidavits, et cetera, et cetera. Now, usually when they have a confidential informant, not usually, all the time, the U.S. attorneys in those situations will redact the confidential informant's name in all cases and just put in its place confidential informant. And sometimes they'll identify them with a serial number, but it's confidential informant. And Harvey's name appeared in different papers in this case, in a number of different places, and they redacted his name in all places except one. Somebody forgot to redact his name, and his name was there in one of the papers, became known to the defendants when they looked it over and realized who set them up. It was Harvey, and as I said before, he was dealing with some bad guys. And apparently, there was not much of a mystery about it. These guys, some, although nobody had any proof, either had him killed or killed him himself. And it was terrible, and I had to go. I felt really, really upset about the whole thing, especially with the assistant U.S. attorney who failed to redact Harvey's name. And my next time, I was scheduled to go to federal court on something else. And when I went there, I made it my business to look up this assistant U.S. attorney. And I confronted him. And I said, you know, I used to represent Harvey, and you got him killed because you didn't redact his name. You were careless. I said, and that's on your conscience. And the guy looked at me with a cold look, totally indifferent. And he said, well, these things happen. Turned around and walked away like it was nothing. And thinking back on the whole thing about the difficulty of representing somebody who's reprehensible or personally abhorrent. First of all, Harvey wasn't that personally abhorrent when you got to know him, and he was basically abused and he was a victim. And I'm a sucker for underdogs or people that have got bullied or abused anyway. But in this case, Harvey wasn't nearly the most abhorrent character, even though he was an informant and a rat. The most abhorrent and reprehensible characters were the assistant U.S. attorney and the federal agents who used him and abused him. Thanks for listening. Come back next week for another episode of Uncommon Law, Lessons They Don't Teach in Law School. I'm Judge Rudy Greco. Court is adjourned.